Wednesday night edition of the Dunktime Basketball Podcast. Awesome, awesome game in a series that I have been just enjoying the hell out of. Charlotte and Miami. Charlotte coming away with a 90-88 victory, taking game 5 on the road. The Warriors also close out the Rockets. The Clippers lose game 5 at home as well to Portland, although we're not going to talk about that game that much. And a feature that I've been really wanting to do for a while, worst team all defense. We are presented today by our sponsors, Betterment and Vistaprint. And joining me to talk about all this, Danny LaRue.
You mean we're not going to go possession by possession down the wire in that Blazers-Clippers game?
No, we will not, in fact, be doing that. I'm going to call it the 2016 Memphis Grizzlies corollary, that any playoff team that the talent it puts on the floor would win 30 games or less over the course of a full season does not get to get talked about unless they actually win a game.
However, I will mention one important swing part of that game, just because we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, is that the Clippers actually led by 5 points at halftime. They were up 50-45, and then they didn't score for almost the first 6 minutes of the second half, and then by that point, that five-point lead had become a five-point deficit, and they never led again.
Okay, that concludes our obligation to discuss that game. Let's talk about Charlotte and Miami. You and I watched this game together, sitting in the media room before the Warriors-Houston game, and the biggest thing that just stuck with me from this one is just these Charlotte guys just toughed it out. Like Nick Batum, it was reported that he was out for the series, although the assumption was that with him out and them down 2-0 and having gotten blown out the first two games, that there might not even be a Game 5 in this series. And he played in it and was clearly hobbled, but hit two enormous threes in the fourth quarter, held up okay defensively. Cody Zeller went flying into the stands. I think he must have injured his knee at that point. He was limping up and down the floor, still beating guys up and down the floor. His mobility, his help defense was fantastic. Jeremy Lin tweaked his ankle early in the game. He was just gutting it out as well. Didn't have his normal mobility. Kemba Walker, although I don't think he was injured, was just exhausted and didn't have his usual burst towards the end of the game. And I was so impressed with the effort of this team of a bunch of guys who, you know, don't have really much playoff experience, certainly not as a group. And I just really enjoyed this Hornets team all season, and I've really enjoyed their effort in these playoffs.
Yeah, it was a really nice run. And while they, you know, have those guys who don't really have experience, they certainly have a lot of talent and they have a lot of effort. And yeah, it was impressive top to bottom. I thought Marvin Williams stood out. I thought he did a really, really nice job in this game. And then, of course, we'll talk about it a lot later. Courtney Lee only had one rebound, but that rebound was gigantic.
Yeah, Marvin, I thought, 10 shooting possessions, 17 points, plus 8 on the night. Started the 3, played a lot of 4 as well, especially down the stretch. His versatility was so key as a guy who can play both of those positions, can switch, still hold up okay on the glass. He really contained Joe Johnson quite well when they were matched up one-on-one at times. He hit some enormous jump shots as well down the stretch. I really was impressed by what he was able to do. And I thought really a key moment for Charlotte was at the beginning. I still was worried about them starting Kaminsky and Jefferson together, and those two guys were both well into the negative for them. But the Heat scored their first 4 buckets, 4 of 4 from the field, all right at the rim. And I think it was 8-0 Heat, or at least 6-0 Heat. And you thought, oh man, like, is Charlotte just going to get blown out just like they did in games 1 and 2? Are the Heat going to restore order? And then Charlotte came right back and actually took a lead at the end of the first quarter by 3. That, to me, was kind of the key sequence of the game to where they were able to say, all right, no, we're not going to let this happen to us again.
Yeah, I thought that was a really important development. I was also very encouraged, even though he didn't play, you know, particularly great, just to see Spo try Josh McRoberts in this game, because the idea was that, as you said yesterday, he couldn't do worse probably than Amari Stoudemire, and it's good to see a coach try something new when something isn't working.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, McRoberts was not really particularly impressive in this game. Had a ton of record scratches on the perimeters where he just passed up jumpers, looked rusty, was not fantastic contesting at the rim, but he at least has a little bit more mobility than Stoudemire. I thought he played slightly better than Stoudemire, and McRoberts actually, you know, was just even on the night. But really, part of the story, and part of this is because the Hornets aren't starting their optimal lineup, but their bench overall really hurt Miami's bench And that was a key for them getting back in the first quarter. And then again, coming back after what had been a pretty ugly third quarter as well.
Yeah, something that amused me, despite that advantage, that was that we've talked before about how Jeremy Lin is put in a really good sort of circumstance in this playoffs just because of the way that Miami's rotations are going. He had a little bit of time with Josh Richardson on him in this game, and that seemed to be real tough for him. But he still stuck it out and had a solid game.
Yeah, I thought that Richardson has definitely shown us something defensively in this. I mean, he's always been great all year, actually, but I think he has the potential to be almost like a taller Patrick Beverley, not a guy who's going to run pick and roll on his own, but a guy who's shown the ability. I think after the All-Star break now, he's at 53% on threes, including the playoffs, which is that's good. And I think defensively, he could even be a little bit better than Beverley because he's taller. He'll have more switchability, more ability to kind of contest from behind on the pick and roll as well. So I think he is a bright future. Now, you could definitely argue the merits of whether he should be closing games over Goran Dragic as he has the last two. But you know, I still think he's a nice player. And against this team that's playing two really good pick and roll point guards, I think that he has a great role. What else stood out about this one to you?
I thought Hassan Whiteside was solid. I didn't think he was, you know, otherworldly like the two other. When I thought he was played great the first two games at Miami, but I thought he did a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think throughout most of the game he did. But as we do our little breakdown of the last few minutes, you see that he basically every shot that Charlotte got, just about except the Lee three-pointer, was at his expense. Just his immobility getting out of the lane. They really exploited that. He also only was able to get two offensive rebounds in this game. That's another thing that Charlotte has really been able to clean up. They held the Heat to six offensive rebounds. And again, it was so out of character for them the way they played in the first two games, giving up offensive rebounds. This is, you know, one of the greatest defensive rebounding teams that we've seen. I just appreciate what they're able to do with not that much traditional defensive talent. You know, and there's no one on this team that you look at as a rim protector. There's no one on this team that you look at as like a dead bang perimeter stopper. You know, Courtney Lee is a guy who has a lot of effort and tries, but he doesn't have the elite physical tools that a lot of the perimeter stoppers do. And they're just so sound and they're so disciplined and so well coached that they just do not let you get buckets in the paint when they're going right. And they generally don't give up that many three-pointers either. And they choke off the defensive glass and they don't turn the ball over. And so all of those things, when you know can cobble together some decent offense, that's a winning combination.
And their challenge will be consistently, you know, now and moving forward, cobbling together that decent offense. But they have those other pieces so well in place that it's a lot of fun to watch them. And if they make it to the next round, which, you know, now, of course, they're one game away, I think they could give either team on the other side trouble just because they're so consistent and they're so disciplined.
Yeah, that's actually a question I wanted to save till later, but I'll just ask you now. Who do you think is, having seen these teams now in the playoffs for five games apiece, who is looking like the best of that 3-6 group in the East to you right now?
I think Toronto has the highest ceiling because especially...
Well, three through six.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So the 3-6. Yeah, the 3-6 mafia.
Yeah, all the teams that tied with
the
38 and 34.
Oh, God. I mean, Atlanta-Boston has been so... maybe Charlotte. I mean, Charlotte's, they've looked consistently good, and Miami, like, I just thought they shot out of their minds those first two games. They've been fine, you know, like, but it's almost as close as it was in the regular season. Then the other two, you're sitting there in this situation where, you know, like, they've each had really good games and really terrible games. But I guess I'd lean Charlotte, but I could listen to an argument for any of the four.
I would go Atlanta, I think, just because, to me, their two losses were much more aberrational.
That's fair.
They're still getting wide open shots and they just weren't hitting them. I mean, I felt like they were even outplaying the Celtics even in those two games in Boston. Now, granted, Boston doesn't have Avery Bradley and that doesn't help much. And Olynyk has been a shell of himself in the games that he's played. And, you know, they've really blown them out at home as well, with the exception of that game one. But even in that game one, they were up big at 1.2. So I would say the Hawks and then maybe the Hornets afterwards, especially if the Hornets can really get Batum healthy and get, you know, they're starting this Jefferson Kaminsky starting lineup, which I hope they won't stick with. If they could get back to their normal starting unit, if Batum really can, like, be healthy and play starters minutes, which I don't know that he can, by the way. I mean, he really, the fact that he was able to play 25 minutes in this one, I thought was pretty miraculous. You know, he clearly is not 100%, but impressive gutting it out from him, especially when you consider he's a guy who, you know, has probably $80 million on the line here as a pending free agent. Him being willing to suck it up certainly deserves a lot of credit. And you know, so many guys who are going to be pending free agents have been playing hurt in these playoffs and really deserve to be commended for it. So getting back to this game, I like talking about Frank Kaminsky because I think he's a really kind of polarizing figure, both with the way he was drafted, how he's kind of been off and on in these playoffs. But I think the reality has been at this point that he's had essentially one good quarter in five games right now.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it. And that quarter was quite good, but the rest of the time, he hasn't really been much of an asset for them because, as you've said numerous times, he doesn't really do the big man things, which is a problem because he's not so good at everything else to justify it.
Yeah, and he did actually shoot his threes with no hesitation. He was 2 out of 5 in this game, which I liked. He wasn't really, didn't try to get his driving game going at all. They didn't bother with him in the post the way they did in Game 4. And really, that one good quarter that he had was when he was being guarded by really small guys. When he's had Luol Deng on him, he hasn't been able to get going. And Deng, if you're a small and you're listening to this and you want to guard Frank Kaminsky, because, you know, I'm sure so many NBA players listen to this show, but Deng showed how to do it. When he puts the ball on the floor, a lot of guys like, oh, he's this big, slow white dude. Like, I'm just going to reach him and steal the ball for him. And then he can kind of get like those spin moves going. What Deng did is he just moved side to side, got his chest in front of him every time he tried to spin. He's not like incredibly quick, and he's not so strong that he's just going to knock you backward on those plays either. So Deng was able to stop him pretty well. And, you know, I think if Batum is healthy, that they should probably get back to going with Zeller and Williams as the starters. We'll see what the prognosis is on Zeller as well after he injured his knee. Hopefully he'll be all right. But, and then Al Jefferson, although he was 7 out of 14 in this game, he didn't really get much in the post. A lot of it was just kind of pick and roll style plays. And he's not a great pick and roll guy, but was able to just kind of get open right at the rim. You know, it wasn't much value added from him. And Whiteside, I think, has actually kind of figured him out in the post now, to his credit. I think he is finally adjusted after five games of playing against him. And Jefferson also is not a guy who draws a ton of fouls. So the idea of getting Whiteside in foul trouble, I don't think that is something that's going to work anymore. But Jefferson can absolutely eat against any of the Heat backup centers, especially if they're not going to play Haslam, which they probably won't. McRoberts or Stoudemire would be completely powerless guarding Jefferson in the post. So I think getting him back with the second unit could be useful. And then really, if Batum is ready to go and can play his full minutes, I think minimizing Kaminsky almost entirely to the best that you can. I mean, playing him a little bit with the second unit is not the end of the world. And then he also will be guarded by someone like Justice Winslow and can guard Winslow on the other end. He won't have to deal with having to chase Luol Deng around. So I think Charlotte, as long as they have enough health, should just go back to their normal starting unit. And that was pretty much what closed the game, except they had Lin in at times for Batum.
The only thing I would add is that it would be worse for Lin just because he would have a less effective pick and roll partner, but I don't think that's worth, you know, that downside doesn't make you reconsider. It's just a downside.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and that is, we have talked about that, and Lin has been killing it, although now that they went to McRoberts, it's not as good as it was with Stoudemire. If they go with Stoudemire, then maybe you might want to try to get Zeller in there a little bit more. But Zeller also just, you know, he's mobile, but he's not like the greatest finisher himself either. Like, he will miss a lot of shots around the rim too. So, you know, I don't think it's the end of the world as long as they're going to close with their real lineup in both halves, which they did. At least in the second half, but it's going to be something to monitor as well. But, you know, the health situation probably is something, especially Zeller. If they don't, I thought Zeller might be like out for the game when he went out and was reported he went back to the locker room. Like, without him, they would have been in big trouble. They would not have been able to stop the Heat down the stretch the way they did.
You ready to do the final stretch of this game?
Yes, absolutely. We'll pick it up where at 84-82 after Deng had just hit a three. And at that point, before Deng hit that three, Spo was actually coming back with Dragic. He was at the table. And then once they went up, I guess he felt like, all right, we have the lead. We're going to just stick with Richardson instead. And this started a series of plays in which Charlotte just went at Hassan Whiteside over and over again to get outside jumpers by screening with the man that he was guarding, and he was rooted to the paint. What they did as an ATO after Deng hit that three, Zeller set a monster screen for Marvin Williams on Deng, and Marvin coming up from, you know, to the top of the key at a pretty steep angle. It was good footwork by him to actually step into it, take a hop, and get his three off. His quick release three was looking awesome in this game. That was a huge play. Might have one of the bigger shots of the game to make it 85-84. And, you know, that was sort of the Marvin had another one of those jumpers earlier in the half. And another play on Whiteside that isn't within this time frame, but Batum's second three-pointer as well was also at Whiteside's expense. Late clock, too, which is what makes it even more inexcusable that he's not getting out there.
Yeah, it's going to be a problem, and that's something you have to think about. Especially, you know, he's not the youngest guy in the world, even though he's had kind of this weird circuitous route in the league of just how much better is he going to get in those kind of coverage situations.
So Dwayne Wade hit then two shots in a row, scoring what were, in fact, the final two Heat baskets, giving them an 88-85 lead. He was able to pull up from mid-range over Zeller on one of them. The other one, he was able to get right to the basket, but then kind of pull up for a floater before the help came over, you know, able to overpower Lee a little bit on that play. So they're up by three with 2:25 left, and then Lin hit what I thought was a three when he shot it. Another play where he just came off a screen from Zeller, Whiteside nowhere to be found, and just got a wide, wide open jumper. It just turned out that his toe was on the line, but then they were within one.
Yeah, and so then you're sitting there. Miami's only down 1 point, and they run a 2-1 pick and roll. And
yeah, Miami was up.
Yeah, sorry, Miami was up one. It was 88-87. Miami runs a 2-1. Runs a 2-1 pick and roll, which we both, of course, love. They didn't switch.
That's Richardson setting the screen right there, since Dragic was still out.
Right. But they didn't switch. They recovered, which is great if you can pull it off. Richardson drove, got it to Deng in the corner. But then it got to Wade, and that led to the problem because Wade can't shoot in those kind of circumstances. So then the ball goes back to Richardson, but he didn't have any time.
Yeah, and Wade made the right pass initially to get it to Richardson at the top of the key. And Walker, who had been guarding Richardson, closed out. Marvin Williams came all the way over from Luol Deng in the corner up to the top of the key. And Richardson should have just moved the ball. Actually, no, I'm sorry. It was Joe Johnson, I think, who was open. Should have just moved the ball to Joe Johnson, who would have had a wide open three. Richardson did not see him. He drove and then finally got it over to him. And at that point, they swung it around the horn. Wade would have been wide open for a three, but Wade can't shoot three-pointers. And so he record scratched just threw this flaming bag to Richardson. And it was interesting to hear some of Wade's quotes after the game. He said, essentially, you know, I didn't want to play hero ball. I wanted to pass it. And on some of those, actually, I think he probably overpassed it, frankly, which, I appreciate the sentiment from him of trying to do that because I think he has played a lot of hero ball this season, you know, with maybe higher of a usage rate than he should have had. But, you know, none of his passes, either because they were too late in the clock or just, you know, guys weren't really as open as he thought they were really any good, frankly.
Yeah, it's a challenge to deal with, and especially when, you know, there's a surge to a point of fives that can shoot at least a little bit, and one of those is not in Miami. So, I mean, it is when Chris Bosh is there, but that makes it even harder when you're an offense if you have two guys who can't really shoot from distance.
Yeah, the next time down, Lin, feeling his oats, took a transition three with Whiteside, again, rooted to the paint, nowhere to be found. Joe Johnson, to his credit, who was guarding Lin, and that was a favorable matchup for Charlotte on the offensive end, was able to just kind of sneak under the screen. I think he surprised Lin with a late contest and made him miss it. But again, you know, another indication of how Whiteside can be a liability when you're really, really trying to attack him. And then the next time down was a 2-4 pick and roll, and Deng tried to drive instead of just moving it to Richardson, who was wide open. And then he lost it trying to do an alley-oop to Hassan Whiteside. And, you know, Zeller did some nice help, but unfortunately, Deng just lost it out of bounds. Richardson saved it. And then that was going to be the Courtney Lee easy layup. Dwayne Wade, of course, didn't get back on defense because that is not exactly his specialty. But he did get back enough to force what everyone was crying for a goaltend. It didn't look like on the replay that Wade actually hit the ball or hit the glass when the ball was on the glass. I think Lee just missed it.
Yeah, it was one of those plays where it was so shocking when it happened that you kind of thought, oh, well, something happened here.
Yeah, you thought it had to be something, right?
And the other possibility, I don't think he hit the basket. I thought it was a possibility he hit the glass, but he didn't hit the... If you think he didn't hit the glass, then, yeah, it's a shot.
Well, he did, but it was well after the ball had already come off the glass.
Okay.
So it didn't affect anything. I mean, if you hit the glass at the same time as the ball is hitting the glass, sometimes that can, like, cause it to reverberate off the glass in a different way. But, so then they had a 5-on-4, and I couldn't tell who... You know, they're still up by one. Wade turned around as soon as he crossed half court, looked back, and called a timeout. I didn't see Spo make any kind of a motion for a timeout. I doubt that, like, Wade could have heard him completely across the court. Maybe he did. So that might have been Wade's call to do a timeout. They had the advantage, but they're also up one, you know, with about a minute left. So maybe they felt like, all right, we just want to waste time anyway here. But they did give it up an advantage because Lee was, like, way into the stands after having missed that layup.
Yeah, and teams have to, you know, have to have that idea to press any advantages they get. And it's not like they were up 6 points with a minute to go where you really do want to slow it down something like that. They were up just 1 point. So I think that was a poor decision personally.
Another 2-1 pick and roll that they went to, they've decided to do that instead of 2-5 pick and rolls because just Seller was doing a good job. I probably would have rather gone with the 2-5 pick and roll instead. But, you know, and Wade had it going. He was 11-19 in this game. Like, I understand why, and nobody else on the team really did. I understand why they went to him, especially with Dragic not in the game. You know, Wade pick and roll is probably the best that you're going to do. Although I wouldn't consider Wade necessarily an elite late game option anymore. He's probably the best that they had going. But Wade and Richardson didn't quite have the chemistry on it. Like, Richardson was set up to actually set a great screen for Wade going to his right hand. Walker would have been on the wrong side to help. And then Richardson actually switched the screen at the last moment, sending Wade right into Walker. And they weren't really able to get anything. And then since they had run the clock down so much, he threw it back to Richardson with 3 seconds on the shot clock, and he had a bomb, like a 27-footer that predictably missed. And then I really liked that Charlotte didn't take a timeout after this one.
Yeah, I mean, you want to see if you can do something there. They did have plenty of timeouts, so it wasn't an issue where they were consciously conserving them. And they ended up doing a 1-5 pick and roll, so, you know, more traditional point guard center. And Kemba, you know, I thought it was an okay look, but I also thought Whiteside did quite a good job.
Yeah, this is Walker, actually, 3 of his 4 made shots. He was 4 out of 18 from the field, were three-pointers. He did not, though, attempt to take a three-pointer on this one. I guess when you're only down one, that makes sense. And he snaked the pick and roll. Whiteside actually got out to the free throw line, contested really well. But the fact that Whiteside had to come out on it is kind of what led to the offensive rebound. People were blaming Dwayne Wade for not boxing out Courtney Lee. Again, he does not really deserve the blame on that, I don't think, because he was trying to block out Cody Zeller, the man who had set the pick and roll, because Whiteside had already had to step out. So Zeller was right under the rim, and Wade went to box him out. It was just a great play by Courtney Lee, again, to run out towards the free throw line. And Joe Johnson just, you know, got beaten to the ball by Lee, who, you know, is a better athlete and is faster and probably, you know, a little bit more of a hustle guy than Johnson is. And then Lee was able to get it right back, and Wade was still stuck with Zeller underneath. You know, he couldn't just leave Zeller wide open under the basket. And Hassan Whiteside was just kind of stuck in the middle guarding nobody. I mean, again, I don't know that I necessarily blame anyone here, because you just have to communicate so quick. And it all started because they got a little bit out of whack with, you know, Whiteside contesting the shot by Walker. And so that's how Lee was able to get that wide open three, which he knocked down. I think it was 1 of 8 before that shot, he finished 2 of 9, although 2 of 2 on threes for Courtney Lee. Good for him. And it was really nice to see from Lee that he was able to exercise the demons a little bit, hit a clutch shot finally in the playoffs, you know, even going back to that 2009 game two where he missed that alley-oop that could have, I think, won the game, actually, or at least tied it in game two against the Lakers in the finals, and then that layup that he had just missed Reggie Miller style right before then.
Yeah, it was really nice to see in that perspective. It was also the second game in a row, I believe, that Courtney Lee had a massive offensive rebound in the last minute of the game. And
yeah, no, he had two on the last two Hornet possessions in game four. So yeah, he was, and they're all of them were like right at the free throw line too. And he did exactly something that you're always advocating, which I was surprised none of the other Hornets did it. Like Marvin Williams didn't crash at all. He was just sort of sauntering back. Now, granted, Steve Clifford has embedded that into these guys' DNA that we're not going for offensive rebounds, we're getting back. But when you're down one with 20 seconds left and you just missed a shot, you know, you probably should be going for it. But anyway, that Lee's instincts to do that definitely really helped. Maybe Clifford hasn't been able to get him out of going after offensive rebounds yet. He's coming from Memphis, where they were probably a little cooler with that. So then the last play, really excellent, excellent Hornets defense. Wade tried to drive. He got stopped, threw it to Joe Johnson. Marvin Williams locked him up, and then Wade was able to blow past Courtney Lee. And I thought Wade had the play at the rim. Kemba Walker did an awesome job of feinting. When Wade decided to pass it, Walker actually was on the block, but he had made the play to feint in, and he knew already when he feinted in that he was going to stop on a dime and then break back out to Dragic. That's what he did, and he was able to get there and block Dragic's jumper, and Wade got the rebound on the baseline, and then I thought that was a clear foul, frankly, on Zeller. What did you think of that?
Absolutely foul. It's a really frustrating thing. As much as I value and like verticality, running at somebody with your arms up in the air is not verticality. Standing in your spot and having your arms up in the air is verticality. So he moved towards Wade, who was already in the air, and made a pretty substantial amount of body contact. But you could kind of see from Zeller's face, like, well, my arms are in the air, it's not a foul. And the refs were cool with it for some reason. But yeah, he absolutely should have gone to the line.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at where Zeller took off from, you know, he jumped forward like 5-6 feet in the air. I mean, he may have even jumped from, like, if not under, like, on the other side of the rim, like under the rim, and he just slammed forward into Wade with his chest. If Wade had actually been able to get it up, Zeller's arms were also forward as well. Like, so if he had just been able to get his arms into contact with Zeller's, he probably would have gotten the call. But yeah, I mean, the verticality thing, and I've been noting this a little bit too much. I think that while I don't like any contact at the rim just being called, I think that not enough fouls are being called at the rim, and too many are being called out on the perimeter for as like kind of BS shooting fouls. And this was maybe the ultimate manifestation of that, where, you know, it was just like he just jumped forward and he slammed into him with his chest. I mean, it was a pretty obvious foul to me. And, you know, that was the game, essentially. I totally understand the beef from Miami fans on that one. But, you know, in this game, it's not like Charlotte got the lion's share of the calls. They only took 15 free throws when they've been shooting a ton of them all series. So overall, I think that the refereeing evened out pretty well through the course of the game. And, you know, if you want to win a playoff game, my answer is, you know, don't be down two with 10 seconds left when you're playing at home. But, you know, still, they got robbed a little bit.
Yeah, it was a bad call. And at the same point, and I've said this for years, it's just as much as any singular bad call is frustrating at the end of a game, when it is that close, that late, you have to accept that there is that kind of a risk involved. And some people wish that that weren't the case, but it is, and you have to deal with it.
Yeah, another one where, you know, Steve Clifford said in his now what will probably be a famous rant if they go on to win this series of sticking with the program, that, you know, he doesn't know until he watches the film. And this the whole Wade thing was or the Lee offensive rebound thing and blaming Wade for it was another example of that. Last night it was, you know, blaming Monte Ellis for the quick two when the play was a hammer play that got snuffed out by Norman Powell. Like, you really do have to go back and watch the film on some of these plays and see, you know, really what happened. Just saying, oh, Wade was guarding Courtney Lee at the start of the possession and Courtney Lee got a rebound, therefore it's Wade's fault. Like, that's way too simplistic.
Yeah, it is. And that's, you know, it's always important to go back and really get that context. And that's also one of the challenges of any sort of defensive metric, is the idea, it's on the same idea, not this specific example, of knowing basically who messed up and led to the basket, because it's not always the closest defender or anything like that.
What do you think happens in the series now?
My best guess is that Charlotte wins game six, but it is not...
Who could have predicted that, by the way?
God damn it. At least I get to take solace in the fact that I beat you in predictions last year, which yeah, I'm sure still bothers you. a little bit.
Did you beat me in predictions last year? What? How did you end up winning it?
I was ahead of you by like one weird thing, and then you got kind of mad because I think I picked the finals first, and then you had to pick something weird, and then that didn't end up like you. I think you had to pick like Cavs and.
Oh no! I picked Hawks to make it to the
That's
finals.
What it was.
Yeah, that was in hindsight that was so, yeah, because I had the early lead because I had picked Clippers in seven and you had picked Spurs in seven, and so I was ahead and feeling pretty good about myself, and then you picked Cavs and I picked Hawks, and you were
crazy. Anyway, we don't need to rehash those things. So what do you think happens in game six?
Yeah. You know, I want to see what the story is with the Hornets' injuries still. I want to see, especially Zeller. He was awesome in this game. Like, his mobility, even though he can't block a shot, just being able to, you know, and it was key on that last play as well, which was probably a foul, but just getting your chest in front of guys and doing it further away from the rim so that they can't just go over you is a very underrated skill. It's not always about blocking shots. Like, he did a better job in this game of protecting the rim and playing defense as a center than Hassan Whiteside did, even though, you know, Whiteside has 10 times the physical gifts that Zeller does, other than maybe his stamina and speed. So it was enlightening. I mean, I'm not sure whether you feel like, all right, Cody Zeller is like some awesome center for you just because of his offensive limitations, but it's really one of the better games that he's played. And if he's out, now you really don't have any center who is decent on defense, and I think that could be a major problem for the Hornets. But they are going to be playing at home. I mean, we'll see what happens with Lynn's ankle, too. You know, is he going to be hobbled by that? Kemba Walker looked really tired in this game. You know, wasn't really able to play that many minutes. He shot terribly and just didn't have his usual burst. Batum, is he going to get better? Did he tweak it? Is he going to be worse? You know, did he come back too soon? All those really questions that I still worry about. But, I think the Hornets will take it. And I think they even could have a decent chance of winning a game seven. I think that they have shown to me over these last three games, the way that they have won these games is more sustainable than what the Heat have done, and that they really have done an excellent job as the series has gone on of taking advantage of the Heat's very specific weaknesses on both ends.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I think I'm more excited for that game six than any game so far in the playoffs.
So before we move on to Golden State and Houston, let's talk about Betterment. You can learn more about them at betterment.com/capspace. That URL is easy to remember because we talk about cap space all the time in the program. Remember, that's a URL. It's not a discount code. But Betterment is the largest independent automated investing service. You've probably been hearing a lot about them in TechCrunch or the Wall Street Journal, other news programs as well. Betterment makes it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest. It's built on smarter, cutting-edge technology that brings you sophisticated investing and financial advice, all at a lower cost than more traditional financial services. More than 150,000 customers have chosen Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and beautiful user interface to manage over $4 billion of their dollars. And it's the perfect time to get started with them because Dunked On listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees. Learn how at betterment.com/capspace. That's betterment.com/capspace. Investing made better.
A team that has some time now to focus on their investments, the Houston Rockets.
Yeah, Dwight Howard specifically. We'll see how much money he's going to get to invest. You know, Jason Terry guaranteed a victory. Marcus Thompson theorized that he did that just so that Golden State would come out and not mess around and make sure that the series would be over. I don't know whether I buy that or not, but that's kind of a funny theory. But yeah, Golden State just hit them right for the jump. They hit two threes. They took a 6-0 lead. And the first half was just a remarkably bad offensive performance for everyone in Houston that wasn't named James Harden. They just were taking all the right shots like Daryl Morey would have loved. And they were 6 out of 25 on shots at the rim and threes. 2 of 15 on threes, 4 out of 10 at the rim, and then a further 3 out of 11 in the paint. Just a miserable shooting performance. Dwight Howard, every one of his shots, it seemed like, was rimming out. Couldn't get anything going. Trevor Ariza had a nightmare series. Just could not hit a three. He struggled and was 1 out of 8. Howard somehow was 3 of 13, although he did have 21 rebounds, 11 offensive rebounds, and curiously actually asked to stay in the game. He played the entire second half And just for whatever reason, I guess he wanted to like leave the right impression in the hearts of Houston fans by continuing to try and finishing the game out with the likes of Montrezl Harrell at the three and Capella at the four, and Andrew Gadlock, whom he also actually finished out his Lakers career with, I think, in a desultory playoff loss, come to think of it.
Well, and I was thinking about Dwight Howard's last playoff loss, which was also in Oracle Arena, though fortunately this one ended with a lot less acrimony because he had that weird elbow to Andre Iguodala's throat, slash head, I think it was throat, at the end of that series. But for me, the story, well, there are two big stories, and I'll start with what was the bigger one early but smaller overall. In the first quarter, James Harden made 6 of his 8 shots, and the rest of the Rockets made 0 of their 15. That's a problem.
Yeah, and I think Harden had 35 of their 81 points.
25 of 37 in the first half, which is more than two-thirds.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really just, and say what you will about this Rockets team having no togetherness, having no fight. You know, yeah, you can say that their transition defense was pretty miserable. I thought their half court defense actually was okay in this game, and Klay Thompson started hitting some ridiculous shots at times as well. But they don't have any good offensive players on this team other than James Harden.
Yeah, I mean, one of the hallmarks to me of a good offensive player is somebody who can create reliable, clean looks for themselves or for other people. You know, if they can do both, that's great, but if they can do one of those, that's fine. And they have one of those guys. That one is James Harden.
And they don't even have anyone who's like a reliable three-point shooter to convert looks for me either. I mean, I guess Beverly shoots okay, but he's not like, and he gutted through a hamstring injury in this one, but Beverly is not, you know, some great spot-up three-point guy. So, you know, I mean, the way that they cycled through guys at the four, right? I mean, every game it was somebody different, except for KJ McDaniels.
And except that it was never Terrence Jones.
Yeah, and Terrence Jones, you know, didn't play a minute in the series, I don't think. And you know, maybe he's just not feeling right or something. Like, it does seem to be, he's had a lot of injuries this year, and maybe that has something to do with it. But I decided to ask JB after the game, you know, why we didn't see more from the young guys in this series when, you know, he was kind of clearly shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic trying to find something that worked. And here's what he had to say.
Coach, how come we didn't see too much of the young guys, Capella and McDaniels, in this series?
We went with, you know, veteran guys who we believed could get the job done. You know, I think those guys have a long history of doing those things. You know, Clint's going to play behind Dwight. You know, it's simple as that. Dwight's going to play. You know, KJ's playing behind Trevor. Trevor's earned the right to be on the floor. All season long, he's been our most dependable guy. Any defensive assignment that we've asked him to play, he's played. So guys like that, you know, in these moments, you ride them. You give them their opportunity. You give them their just due.
So, you know, my reaction to that is a couple of things. Number one, I don't think anyone would have been saying, and I wasn't saying, obviously, that KJ McDaniels should play over Trevor Ariza. You know, and I don't think that that was the question. It was, who's really going to play at the four? You know, and it could have been Capella at the four. It could have been McDaniels at the four. And I don't think anyone was saying Capella should have played over Howard necessarily either. Although, you know, by this game, it was Josh Smith and who was getting like the backup center minutes by that point. And Howard played 45 minutes. So it was, you know, Josh Smith played like the 3 minutes that he was out in the first half. But, you know, so, and Capella, I think his max number of minutes played was like 6 or something in the whole series. So I think a lot of people would have liked to see either Capella or McDaniels get a chance before. I thought McDaniels was okay in game one. I mean, that wouldn't have changed the series at all. It would have just been nice to kind of see if those guys could compete in the playoffs and, you know, see if they can be part of the plan and you can rely on those guys. But, you know, again, I don't think that that lost them the series, but that wasn't really an answer that I thought was that great a one, frankly. And, you know, anytime someone loses a series, they're not going to give their best answer on a question like that. But so many people had been kind of bringing that up that I felt like I should ask him, you know, in a respectful way and see what his perspective was on it.
Yeah, it was a very frustrating answer to me because it created this false choice, which wasn't really there. And yeah, I understand why you want to play Trevor Ariza and why you want to play Dwight Howard. They were very important to your success. However, there were minutes for guys that were not those players that went to, you know, that went to Josh Smith, that went to Michael Beasley and Corey Brewer. And those guys didn't work. It didn't work in this series. And so one facet you mentioned well, which is the idea of getting more information on those young guys, and not only getting them more information, but getting more experience, because hopefully they're going to be in the playoffs in future years. But the other important part is, if you have these other things that aren't working, maybe they are inferior players, but you might as well see if it works, because that's your chance to go in the series. You already know that when you've been butting your head up against a wall, so you can either keep doing that, or you can try something else. And if it fails, you were going to lose anyway, and if it works, then you're a genius. And when you're not only fighting, you know, for your guys, but you're fighting for theoretically for maybe the Houston job or some other job, I feel like a coach owes it to himself and to his team to try every reasonable tool in their arsenal. And it's not like Clint Capella is this off the reservation idea. He's probably going to be their starting center next year.
They started Corey Brewer in game one, and Corey Brewer even got a ton of minutes in this game, in which he was 2 for 8. He hit his first three-pointer since March 25th, and he also had 3 turnovers and 4 fouls. So I definitely think that KJ could have done a better job than Corey Brewer did in this series. And that really, I think, is the only bad contract that Daryl Morey has ever given out, at least that appeared bad at the time that I criticized. And yeah, Brewer is the biggest one, him playing over KJ or playing over Capella and playing the two bigs. You know, either of those, like, Brewer was so bad. There's just no way to believe that that would have been good. And JB was really just grasping at straws. Like, at one point, he did a hack of Andre that created a 2-for-1 for the Warriors. Andre hit both free throws, and then he didn't do it again because I guess he hit both free throws, because, you know, that is more important than whatever statistical information you had on Andre coming in, you know, the sample size of his entire season. So you're not going to do it again now to get yourself another possession. Like, that didn't really make much sense. Like, who he was going with, you know, Josh Smith played 5 minutes and then just never came back in again. Demo started and he was actually only -4 somehow on the night. And he, couldn't really play more than 14 minutes. I thought he probably played the best of any of their power forward options in the series, which is damning with faint praise, to be sure. So, yeah, I would have to say, and the rumor now is that the Rockets are going after Jeff Van Gundy pretty hard, that, you know, JB was in an impossible circumstance, but I would also be hard-pressed to come up with ways in which, you know, he did things that impressed me this year.
And at least we got to see Montrezl Harrell try a corner three and almost try another one.
Let's talk about Howard a little bit now. Calvin Watkins had an excellent, when I was talking to him after the game, I was like, you did a great pre-post-mortem on the Rockets, because, you know, it's kind of fait accompli that they're going to lose this game. And he stated in his piece that, you know, he had a lot of great detail. I recommend that you guys read it, on the Howard and Harden dynamic and how they sort of both tried to make it work and just, you know, weren't really able to, especially on the floor. And so Calvin reported that Portland, Milwaukee, Charlotte, and Orlando are the places that he anticipates Dwight may be looking to go in free agency. What is your reaction to that report?
Well, I think that it depending, of course, on what they're willing to offer him, all of those teams could use a rim protector, and especially Portland doesn't need a lot in terms of offensive production. The challenge with Dwight Howard is, will he accept a different role than he's had? You know, like, whether that's playing 20 minutes a game, let's say, during the regular season, then of course ramping it up, or saying, hey, you're not going to get these post touches like he did at the beginning of this game. If he's willing to do that, Portland, Orlando could be interesting. I mean, I don't love him with Milwaukee just because that becomes spacing death. And I mean, it's very hard to find the perfect fit at the four, at the five for them, considering what they're doing, though. Of course, everybody knows how much I love Giannis. And Charlotte, I mean, they've been able to do it without a rim protector. So I don't love that fit. But those are the types of, I'm happy he's thinking about those markets, though, because, you know, that means he's not shooting for the, you know, the LAs and the New Yorks of the world, where I don't think he's a good fit for any of those teams.
Watching Howard's post-ups in the series were striking, and really just this entire year. But, you know, he did get his chances in the post at times. And in game three, a little bit, he was able to just really get deep position before he even caught the ball. But, you know, Kevin McHale had an interview on SiriusXM a couple of days ago, and he said basically that, you know, with his back issues, his hips are really tight, and he can't really generate the same power that he used to. And that is really clear because he doesn't knock guys backwards anymore. You know, it used to be if you were guarding him with someone skinny, he was just going to put that guy in the goal and score. And now that's not really the case anymore. You know, he sort of dribbles around. He tries to spin back. His hook shot is always contested. He's a step further out than you really want him to be. And he's going to shoot 35 or 40% on those shots. And he's not getting fouled anymore. I mean, it used to be he would get such great position and was so strong that you just had to foul him. And, you know, he would shoot a ton of free throws. You know, he's up at the top of the league of free throws. And now he only gets fouled when it's Hack of Howard. And you know, he can still get up for alley-oops reasonably well, but he just doesn't have the strength and the power, I think, in his lower body that he once did due to some of those back issues. Maybe his knee issues come in there as well. So, you know, I think he's never going to be a post threat any longer. I think his effort on the offensive glass in this series was exemplary. I think at times he brought it defensively, but he still doesn't have and he showed the ability to get out on the perimeter a little bit. That was one of the things that made him really special in Orlando. But generally, he was sort of rooted to the paint, and you know, I wouldn't trust him to bring the effort to really switch out on the perimeter regularly. The couple of times he did okay still. So I don't know. I mean, I think he could be an okay fit in those places. But, you know, it all depends what the money is, right? If he wants a max contract of $30 million, I would be surprised. Maybe you could find a team that would give him that for like 1 year, you know, just to say, hey, this is the best use of our cap space. We can rehabilitate him and, you know, we'll try and – and there are going to be a lot of teams that are going to have $30 million. You know, I think some of those teams that are on that list will. So and for Charlotte, though, you know, I wouldn't want to sign him instead of like re-signing Batum or, you know, re-signing Courtney Lee or re-signing Marvin Williams. Like those are re-signing Jeremy Lin. You know, I think all those guys will end up being better value contracts than Howard will. But we'll see. You know, maybe he'll just want to try and win and rehab his reputation and take less, you know. So he's definitely going to be one of the more fascinating free agents, to be sure.
Yeah, we'll have to find out what he wants. And something else that concerns me a little bit with him, of course, he was this physical specimen earlier in his career, is he is a kind of that rarity in that he is a real rim protector who was always on the smaller side, and mostly in terms of height, but in terms of that. And I worry about how those guys age, because at least if you're big and you age and you get a little bit slower, you can just put your hands up and you can do more. Like, I think that aging has, being a little bit bigger, I think it helped Kareem a little bit. I think it's helped Tim Duncan, and he just doesn't have the benefit of the doubt there.
Yeah, he does have a pretty good length and standing reach, but you're right. You know, him being compared to Shaq was always a little unfair because he's basically 6'10", you know, and Shaq was 7'1". And just because Dwight was such an incredibly athletic guy, you know, you sort of put him in the same category, but he's not. And, you know, he was never going to age as well as some of those other guys are for that reason. All right, let's get to worst team all defense. But first, let's talk about our friends at Vistaprint. I am a small business owner. That's what this podcast is. And Vistaprint was created to help out people like me and hopefully your small business as well. They're starting off offering 500 business cards for just $9.99 using my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. Very easy to remember, CAPSPACE, of course, because we talk about it all the time on the program. So that's the promo code CAPSPACE. And Vistaprint doesn't just offer business cards. They offer a ton of other custom products for home or office needs. Think postcards, flyers, banners, apparel, invitations, coffee mugs, anything that you want to put some words on or a logo on, they very well might have that. And Vistaprint is basically offering the customer service of your local print shop, but they have the economy of scale of the big boys, and they have less overhead because they don't have these bricks and mortar stores. Nevertheless, Vistaprint absolutely guarantees that you'll love your products every time or they will make it right. They have amazing customer service. They also offer custom design services. If you don't have necessarily a logo or know what you want your business card to look like, they can help you design it as well. So get that introductory offer, 500 business cards starting at just $9.99 using that code CAPSPACE at checkout. That's how they know that you came from us. Helps keep the show on the air. You can get some awesome services from Vistaprint, and we will all win at Vistaprint.com. All right, so I kind of stole this idea from Tim Kawakami, who I don't think actually is doing that column this year, or he hasn't yet.
No, he'll do it before the finals.
Ah, okay, that's his usual.
I think so.
All right.
It's a great column.
We are crediting him, and I will let you go first, Danny. Worst team, all defense for you.
You want to do the whole team or do you want to go position by position?
Let's go by position. That's better. Let's start with point guard.
Okay. My point guard is the biggest star on my team, but Damian Lillard is a magnificently terrible defensive point guard. And, you know, it's statistically it's true, but just when you watch it, and he's, of course, incredible offensively, and that's more important, but he was just rough this year.
He did get destroyed by Chris Paul, and they had to take him off, and that was actually, I think, a big turning point in that series for Portland, before, obviously, the Paul injury was taking Lillard off of Paul. I don't think he's anywhere close to the worst, though. My guy, and the rules was we basically, the guy had to be a starter or like a top six player on a team. Jose Calderon was my guy. I think Lillard has at least had some moments where he's competed and he's athletic enough that, you know, when he's really engaged, he can be like semi-decent. Calderon has zero athleticism left and just cannot get through a screen. He's not going to be able to make anyone uncomfortable. He's never going to get a steal. He's completely useless on help defense. So he was my guy there. I think just his lack of athleticism, he's probably easily to me the least athletic point guard who gets regular minutes and is, you know, kind of a starting type of player.
Is there anybody else you considered?
Isaiah Cannon.
Oh, he's
really,
really rough.
And then I guess Lou Williams would be a guy who defends point guards, maybe.
Yeah, I would put him more at the
two. He's like a 1-2. But yeah, that was at the point guard. I thought Calderon to me was above and beyond.
So my two guard is a fellow Bruin, Zach LaVine, my thought was he was worse in the first half of the year, but actually the team did worse with him on the floor after the All-Star break, which is when he moved to the two guard to play with Ricky Rubio. Somehow the team's defense was worse with him on the floor then, and he gets lost a lot. He's just a real bad defensive player.
Yeah, I tend to give younger guys a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. And I think LaVine also was overmatched having to play point guard a lot as well. I think at shooting guard, he's not as bad. And he actually, you know, I thought he had at least a couple of decent defensive games. Like, and he can get some steals and get out in the passing lanes on occasion. I went with our boy James Harden. I think he just, in terms of setting the defensive culture in Houston, really just brought them down. He reverted back to those levels of 2014. He was much better last year. That's what made it so galling, too, is that he wasn't as good this year. Granted, he had, you know, a nearly impossible task trying to play as many minutes as he did. But even early in the year when this was supposed to be a deep team and he wasn't playing as many minutes, he still really caused a lot of the regression, I think, from Houston on defense. And, you know, just his overall inattentiveness, inability to get out on shooters. I mean, he's okay defending the post. That's really the only thing that he's good at. But then his transition defense, his arguing with the refs and not getting back, losing guys on back cuts, losing shooters, really just a tour de force of bad defense made all the worse by the fact that he was actually passable last year.
Yeah, I think the most kind of the salient point in all that is also that he's his team's best player. And whether it's fair or not, a lot of teams, like, their personality can come from those dominant figures. And not only when he's terrible defensively, but when it looks like he doesn't care, I'm sure that's really hard to take.
My small forward was an absolute legend, Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, mine too.
Really just a miserable Lakers defense all year, playing in a terrible system with Byron Scott, having no energy, saving it all for just jacking up as many shots as possible on the offensive end, having really nobody else around him. You know, like, if the other team had a good wing, like, Kobe had to guard him a lot of the time. There wasn't really anywhere to anybody else, if Kobe was playing, who could guard that guy. So all those things came together to really make it pretty clear that Kobe had to be the worst at the three. Who else did we consider for these wing positions?
I didn't have, of course I considered Harden at the two. I didn't really consider anybody else other than Kobe because he was just such a clear-cut one. I was actually really surprised that Kobe was my only Laker.
Yeah, yeah, well, you should have given Lou Williams more consideration, I think.
Yeah, and I guess he counts as a swingman that's worthy of consideration. I mean, in terms of pure defensive stats, Shabazz Muhammad has been abysmal for the last couple of years. But when I watch him, I don't think, oh my God, this guy is a disaster in the same way as the other guys.
The guys for me, Nick Stauskas,
oh God,
I think was very much responsible for Philly's regression from 12th in defense last year down back into the 20s. He played a lot of minutes and just could not stop anybody, really, you know, doesn't have any kind of force or athletic ability. He's not going to get any steals, and he combines that with some pretty bad inattentiveness as well. I could also throw in Marco Bellinelli, who had one of the worst RPMs in the league on defense and just really reverted from his days in Chicago and San Antonio to fit right into just the defenseless Kings culture in what was, despite all of the resources invested, a miserable bench on both ends, but especially on D. And then Doug McDermott as well, I thought.
Oh, yeah, good call.
Although he does try, he's just, his legendarily low number of blocks and steals just allows guys to isolate on him so easily and just be completely comfortable knowing that he's never going to make any kind of a play on the ball when you're trying to attack him. And then he's, although he does execute at times and has gotten slightly better, you know, with helping off a non-shooters, that's about all he can do. And I didn't pick him, but still just his physical limitations and the lack of force that he plays with are certainly at least worthy of honorable mention.
Okay, so we'll move on to the four. And for me, there of course are people that were considered beyond this, including Jabari Parker. But for me, the guy who stood out was Ryan Anderson, who was just horrendous on defense this year. And he played a lot with AD at center, and those lineups were just bad defensively.
Yeah, it's Ryan Anderson has never been a great defender, but since some of his unfortunate back troubles, it's gotten worse. I went with Dirk because I think he's just so stiff at this point that just in the new NBA, there are very few players where if you switch, you're just dead because you can bring enough help. Even Anderson could switch and not completely embarrass himself at times. But Dirk is just, anytime you put him in a pick and roll, he just cannot move. You know, he's still a very effective player, but I think having him on your defense, especially because he has to play, you know, he's Ryan Anderson, you can take him off the court. Dirk, you're never going to do that. Having Dirk on your defense, I mean, I think it's pretty much impossible to have a top half of the league defense with Dirk out there, you know, almost no matter who else you have. And he'll try, he executes, but he can't get out on shooters. He can't play pick and roll. He can't switch. He can't block any shots, and he just can't move at all. So, and he can't get back on defense. So with all those things, I think he had to be unfortunate, although I love him as a player. This isn't just about making fun of people. It's about trying to actually be objective.
you're just still mad at him for saying that he was done after the Eurobasket.
Oh, for me, yeah. Saying that he was done.
But I'm going to give another honorable mention. He's not in the same caliber of bad defender, but every once in a while, Derek Williams would just have this unbelievable adventure of a possession where just like you'd just be trying to figure out what he was trying to do, kind of like Gerald Green in a way, where he would have those, but he has them a little bit less frequently than Gerald Green. And, of course, the Knicks were rough defensively when he was on the floor, so I wanted to mention him as well.
David Lee, who started earlier in the year in Boston, and therefore I think meets the criteria. I was kind of stretching it a little bit for McDermott and Bellinelli, but I felt like I had to mention them at least a little bit. Jabari also, who you mentioned, just somehow has the ability to just, like, jump in front of guys and pretend like he's helping, but then pretty much just be jumping out of the way. Also, one of the worst defensive rebounders at power forward. He might be the worst defensive rebounding power forward in the league. Just no nose for the ball, just stands up at the free throw line every time. And this was a terrible Bucks defensive rebounding team also, and defensive rebounding obviously is part of defense. So he definitely was up there for me. Let's move on to the centers now. Who do you have at center out of this veritable cornucopia of options?
I know that you don't want to put young guys on, but Jahlil Okafor was pretty spectacularly bad on defense this year, and I think he'll get better. I think that he's not in that group where he'll be in this bottom for that long, but he was one of the other major culprits behind the substantial regression in Philadelphia's defense.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, he had some decent plays once in a while. He could block some shots. Pretty bad defensive rebounder. I mean, certainly someone I had in my honorable mention, but Greg Monroe actually was my center. I felt like the Bucks just could not stop anyone when he was in there. even when he could get there to defend the rim, he was just completely ineffectual every time. Wouldn't really ever take charges at all either. Not even really a great post defender. Not an amazing defensive rebounder for a center. Can't get out on the perimeter and move. Can't defend in the pick and roll. Did I miss anything?
I think that's about it.
Yeah. So he was my number one. And apologies to Enes Kanter, Myers Leonard as well. A guy who was really miscast trying to play power forward defensively. And especially any time he got in a switch, he was just completely ineffectual. And Nikola Vucevic as well was another one for me, who especially maddening that he would be in the game late for Scott Skiles, you know, on defense only possessions and get killed on a pick and roll every single time.
Yeah, that was infuriating.
All right, any other thoughts on this before we wrap it up for today?
It seems like there were less egregiously bad defenders this year than last year. I don't know if that's just me.
Do you think people actually improved?
No, I think some of those guys just played a little bit less. I think Kanter got better. Still bad.
Yeah, Kanter, I think, from last year.
Well, yeah, like no Bargnani this year. I think that was a big change. That's a pretty substantial group. I'm thinking primarily of like the centers. Like the center crop was actually like not horrendous this year.
Yeah, I think teams are just starting to understand that kind of low post scoring center, which seems to have quite a bit of correlation with guys who, you know, can't really defend the rim or play pick and roll defense. You know, I think just A, if you're in the league because of your post up scoring, you're just never been asked to develop that as much, or you may have been asked, but you didn't have to. You still can make a living with your scoring. And also just the kind of wide body guys who are good at scoring in the post, just it doesn't really correlate with great defense. And I think that just generally, for whatever reason, teams are going away from those guys, either because their post-ups are less effective or because they realize that they're not as good on defense, or both.
Yeah, I think that's well said.
All right, you got anything to plug? I know you do, actually.
I do. So The Athletic, the Bay Area branch of it, launched today. Very, very excited about that. And, you know, launched with a couple of different pieces, most notably kind of a breakdown, which is actually behind the paywall right now, of the Kevin Durant situation. I haven't promoted it a lot yet, but that's a really big piece. And then I did a preview on Game 5. And then during the time before we recorded this, I wrote the player-by-player analysis for Game 5, and we'll do a game recap that will be up by the time most people listen to this. So we'll have a lot of new material. Going to try to just, when we're starting this, hitting the ground running, going to try to have valuable, worthwhile new stuff every single day.
Yeah, so if you want to know more about these Warriors games in written form, sounds like The Athletic is going to be the place to go for kind of the most detailed stuff. What's the Twitter handle for that, by the way?
I believe it is Athletic Bay Area. I think that's the handle they ended up with.
All right. Well, give that a follow as well, because I'm sure that there will be tweeting going on from there of all the pieces and the games. And give us a follow as well. Nate Duncan NBA, if you haven't followed me yet, and Danny LaRue as well. Scheduling note, we will actually be back on Friday night, since there's only one game tomorrow. Seemed better to just wait until Friday night, and then we can do that Game 6 of Celtics-Hawks, and then Charlotte-Miami and Portland-Clippers as well on Friday. So we will talk to you all on Friday night. Till then.